I want to thank the committee for inviting me. It's my first trip to Portugal. You see, I'm the only one who's allowed to smoke because I'm the only frightened person in this room. Now, you have received a paper which is the central chapter of a new book on aesthetic conflict and its place in development and in psychopathology. And I want to try, in the brief period I have, to explain to you its relationship to narcissism, to explain to you why this book couldn't have been written 15 years ago when I first tried to write it. And, of course, in order to do that, as in everything in psychoanalysis, seems to me one has to go back to history, the history of ideas, the history of concepts. But, of course, everybody has his own idea of history in this field in particular, so I have to tell you what my idea is of the history of the concept of narcissism that underlies this concept of aesthetic conflict. Now, of course, narcissism began during the period, the concept began during the period in Freud's work when he was still quite dominated by the libido theory, and it therefore was essentially a neurophysiological concept about the distribution of libido and its distribution to the body and to the ego as a stage in development. It was not, in that sense, really a concept of vanity. It was a neurophysiological concept, as was the concept of the mechanism of defense as it developed under Freud. It always had a neurophysiological basis. Now, the work of Melanie Klein was far more revolutionary than she herself recognized, because it changed the meaning of Freud's concepts while retaining the language. And no concept in psychoanalysis changed more in her hands than the concept of narcissism. And I'll try to explain to you in what way it changed. When she started working with children in the 1920s, and children told her about the concreteness of their experience of having figures inside their bodies, she dealt with this as evidence that Freud's concept of superego, or ego ideal, or the two of them together, were not simply concepts about imaginary figures, but that the mind operated on the basis of an absolutely concrete concept of an inner world. That is, that people's mental life is not lived only in the outside world, but is lived also in the inner world, and that the inner world of objects and the construction of the self is the essential process of the developmental process of the personality. By thus outlining what she called the concreteness of psychic reality, she moved psychoanalysis for her followers into a purely Platonic view of mental life. That is, that it shifted it completely from a neurophysiological view of the distribution of psychic energy into a field for the study of the meaning of mental experiences. And that this meaning of mental experiences, that the meaning was generated in the relationships and the creation of objects in the inner world, and that this meaning was secondarily deployed and delegated to figures in the outside world, an essentially Platonic view of mental life. Now, having come to that conclusion about the concreteness of these figures. She also had to assert that they are not simply figures that operate in the imagination, but that they perform functions in the mind, that they are functional figures and not simply imaginary objects. And the functions that she delegated to them were essentially similar to Freud's ideas about superego, that is, of prohibitory rule-making objects, and of ego ideal, of nurturing, encouraging, and supporting functions. So that really in her hands, the concepts of superego and ego ideal came together again and became known as the concept really of internal objects, internal parental figures. Now, that in itself did not alter the concept of narcissism, except that it changed narcissism from a concept of the distribution of libido to a concept that was similar to the ordinary meaning of the word vanity, egocentricity and vanity. But when in 1946 she wrote this little revolutionary paper called Notes on Some Schizoid Mechanisms, in which she described both splitting processes and projective identification, she did something that utterly changed the concept of narcissism. First of all, by going back to Freud's 1939 paper on splitting of the ego in the service of defense and extending it as a process that goes on all the time, that the mind is not unified at all, but is always, the personality is always divided up variously into different parts. She fractured the concept of unity of the mind, and she laid the basis for a different concept of narcissism, in which narcissism became juxtaposed to object relationships. This developed into really an organizational concept of narcissism, no longer a neurophysiological concept as in Freud's hands, no longer a concept simply implying vanity and egocentricity as in early Melanie Klein, but turned into an organizational concept in which it was envisaged that infantile parts of the mental apparatus, infantile parts of the self, tend to organize themselves in groupings which are variously sympathetic to or hostile to the internal objects. Primarily, that they tend to organize themselves in opposition to the influence and domination of the internal objects. Therefore, she produced a structural concept, an organizational concept of narcissism, which could also be the basis not only for studying narcissistic phenomena in the personality, but also the enactment of these narcissistic phenomena in the social life of children, in particularly in the formation of gangs, and therefore particularly in the phenomenology of delinquency. So that was the first step, the change, first of all, into this concrete concept of psychic reality, then an organizational concept of narcissism, and this was then amended by the book called Envy and Gratitude, in which she took Freud's concept of life and death instinct and gave the death instinct the meaning of a particular part of the personality, a particular infantile portion of the personality which was imbued with destructive impulses. In a sense, a satanic part of the personality as the organizer of the narcissistic and delinquent opposition to the rule, you might say, of superego, ego ideal functions of the internal objects. Ooh, I have to have a drink. Now, up to this point, the Kleinian development in psychoanalytic thought and its application to clinical practice, which had an immense influence on the kind of psychopathology we could begin to understand and the range of patients that we dared to undertake treatment of, these concepts did not depart very fundamentally from Freud's model of the mind in terms of ego, superego, and id. But what the 1946 paper introduced in addition to splitting processes was this concept of projective identification. Now, Freud had mentioned identification processes. It runs all through his work in terms of the earliest identification of the ego as a body ego, that there are social identifications, there's introjective identifications by which the superego is produced and so on. And he had also mentioned narcissistic identifications but had never defined it in any particular way. It's particularly in the Schreber case that he mentions narcissistic identifications. But the concept of projective identification was the first description of a mechanism for producing a narcissistic identification. And what a narcissistic identification means is really a change in the state of mind by which the self becomes confused in its apprehension of itself and its qualities, becomes confused with an object into which it has projected itself. Later on, many years later, Mrs. Bick and I produced a second concept of narcissistic identification called adhesive identification, and there probably are other mechanisms by which the state of mind can suddenly be changed into one where self and object are confused with one another as regards their qualities and properties. This concept of projective identification opened up a whole new world of phenomenology, and the people who followed Mrs. Klein have really spent the next 40 years investigating the phenomenology of projective identification. And that, in essence, splitting processes, that is, concreteness of psychic reality, and with it the early stages of the Oedipus complex, splitting processes and projective identification, and the concept of envy as the mental representation of what Freud gathered together under the concept of death instinct, those were essentially Mrs. Klein's contributions to the model of the mind that can be used in clinical work. Her emphasis had always been on the foundations of mental life and the foundations of mental structure being laid down very early in the mother-baby relationship, and in particularly in the baby's relationship to the breast and the meaning that the breast has to the baby. But her concept of the mother-infant relationship was, in a sense, a very biological one. That is, that her view was that the mother's role was primarily one of nurturing and emotional support, and that if the baby was adequately nurtured, protected, and emotionally supported so that its anxieties were kept at a tolerable limit, that its development of its personality simply unfolded like a flower and in its perfection, as it were. Now, Wilfred Bion quite changed all that with his theory of thinking, because he observed that the personality does not just unfold, that the personality has to be constructed, and that it is constructed by thought that resolves conflicts. And that his idea was that thinking is not a ubiquitous function, that thinking has to be learned, and that the primary means by which thinking is accomplished is that emotional experiences are transformed into symbolic representations which can be used for dreaming, and that dreaming is the foundation of thinking. Now, of course, this was an entirely different view of dreams from the view that Freud presented to us in 1900 in the Dream Book, that dreaming was thinking, and that this foundation of thinking in dream process then could be transformed into other symbolic forms, language, of course, being the most important of this in our daily lives. The transformation of dreams' thoughts into language that makes verbal communication possible. Now, of course, nobody knew better than Mrs. Klein that verbal communication is not the only means of communication, because her observations of children's play absolutely taught us that children don't just play to have fun. They play as a means of thinking, and that they play in the therapy situation as a means of communicating. So that nonverbal communication and communication in action and play was perfectly well known. But the idea that the dream and the dream process was the foundation of thinking was a completely new idea, and Bion also related it, therefore, to the mother's relationship to the baby, that it was not simply a nurturing function, a protective function, and a function of modulating the baby's pain, that the mother had to be able to think about the baby, and in thinking about the baby, had to enable the baby to take into himself, to introject into his internal objects, the capacity for thought from which he then learned to think. Not only learned to think, but also that at the foundations of thinking, this baby-breast-baby-mother relationship goes on in the unconscious all the time. Now, this was Bion's revolutionary idea and contribution to the model of the mind, what is called the thinking breast. Now, the concept of narcissism, from this point of view, then took on a new dimension. As Mrs. Klein had moved the concept of narcissism from a neurophysiological one to a meaningful one of vanity and egocentricity, and then to an organizational one having to do with the opposition of the infantile structures organizing themselves in opposition to the parental figures in psychic reality. Bion made an additional move to narcissism in indicating that what went on in narcissistic organization was very impoverished in thought. That in order for thinking to take place, there had to be this dependent and cooperative relationship to internal objects. He defined another form of social organization that is, in a sense, a representation of very primitive narcissism. in which thinking doesn't take place at all. This he defined as what he called the basic assumption groups. Very primitive, tribal types of grouping in which a leader, operating on the basis of a single and simple basic assumption and simply using logical procedures, is able to dictate the necessary actions to his followers to implement this basic assumption. And he defined these basic assumptions as three general types, as fight-flight basic assumption, dependence basic assumption, and pairing basic assumption. But the idea of the basic assumption group as a mindless operation in which the leader dictates the actions of the group, of course, is something that we know really very well from the political arena, particularly from the horrors of the 30s and 40s. But this change from thinking that there was a difference between thinking and the thinking mind and mindlessness, where thinking was not going on, was a very new idea. That in the mind there are two separate areas. There's an area that employs symbol formation, that is in a harmonious relationship with internal objects, and is able to do creative thinking. And that there is another area in which the symbol formation does not take place, in which creative thinking does not take place, and in which actions are dictated by other means of social organization, either the social organization of the gang, which operates primarily on the basis of various types of projective identification amongst the members, or the basic assumption group, which operates on the basis of dictation from the leader, who uses these simple logical operations to dictate actions on the basis of a single basic assumption. So this is where the concept of narcissism reached under the addition of Behan's formulations of a theory of thinking, that narcissism was not only an organizational concept, but an area of mental life in which thinking was impoverished, or in the case of its more primitive forms, that thinking was virtually absent and could be reasonably be called mindless. Now, it's to that development of the concept of narcissism through Behan that I have applied the findings from analysis having to do with the emergence, which I have noticed repeatedly, the emergence mainly toward the end of successful analyses of an intense aesthetic response to the world, to the analysis itself as a process, and to the mind of the analyst as an object within this analytic world. And that recovery of an aesthetic orientation to the world has generated in my mind the idea that this may not be a sophisticated development, as one has always thought of aesthetics and aesthetic responsiveness as a very sophisticated development, because we think of it in connection with appreciation of art and landscape and so on. But that it is possible that the aesthetic response is there from the beginning, that the baby's first experiences of the world, represented, embodied, or you might say incarnate in its mother, and the mother's breast and the mother's face, that the baby's first experiences may be one of an overwhelming impact of the aesthetic qualities of the object, of its formal qualities. But the reason that I have called it aesthetic conflict is because in the analytic situation, one sees that as this aesthetic attitude, this aesthetic vision of the world and of objects emerges, it emerges with very great pain. These pains, it's true, at that point in analysis are very connected with the weaning process, but they are also pain connected with the impact of the beauty of the object and the uncertainty about its interior. That is, that the aesthetic response in its positive form is to the impact of the exterior formal qualities of the object. But what it carries with it is a tremendous uncertainty about the inner structures, which are essentially the mental structures behind this beauty, the meaning, the intentions, the attitudes of this aesthetic object. And that is the essence of this painful conflict, that you can see the beauty, you can touch the beauty, but you cannot see the interior. That you can only construe by observation and thought, and it is always shrouded in uncertainty. And that uncertainty, juxtaposed to the impact of the beauty, makes for a very painful type of conflict from which the baby would tend to retreat. And many babies do retreat. And probably at weaning, all babies retreat to some extent. Unless that aesthetic impact that the mother has on the baby meets a reciprocity in the baby's impact on the mother as an aesthetic object, and that the mother also tolerates the uncertainty of this aesthetic conflict, because the mother has to tolerate the uncertainty about what kind of child, what kind of person this little creature is going to develop into. And in order to preserve her vision of the baby and of the child as an aesthetic object, she must tolerate the uncertainty about its developmental future, which means essentially the development of its mind. So that in essence is the contribution to the evolution of the theory of narcissism, that this concept of aesthetic conflict, which you have written there in that paper, is intended to be. And it's intended, of course, as all these concepts. They're not theories, they're just models of the mind, and they're intended for use in the consulting room. Of course, they're intended for other people to use also in other fields related to psychoanalysis, or sociology, art history, aesthetics, philosophy, whatever. But essentially, they're meant for use in the consulting room. And the writing of this book is really, well, it's something that was germinated back in 1960 when I wrote a book with Adrian Stoke about art and the impact of art. But it could not develop into its present form until I had digested Behan's work and understood the meaning of the thinking breast and the impact between breast and baby on the thinking level, and not simply on the level of emotion and anxiety. Right. Thank you.
My idea was that you mentioned the aesthetic experience as being the result of looking at the mother, the breast, the eyes, the general gestalt, and you also say in the paper you gave us that, high percentage of the children who later become grown-ups, they always say that my mother was beautiful. We would have a high percentage of beautiful mothers for every baby. But my the question I ask you is that you think that the beauty is something that comes from outside. Really, the mother is transformed through the experience of caring for her baby or feeding him and so on. Or if it doesn't come from the inside of the baby, some sort of emotion that is raised, positive emotion that is raised in the baby, and this emotion then it's translated into images. And those images, there is a reality, an affective reality, but this reality gets translated into aesthetic feelings. Feelings of gratitude get transformed into aesthetic feelings, and so they are projected, like projected identification, they are projected on the mother, and so we get the picture of the beautiful mother, or the baby sees the picture of the beautiful mother. But the mother is beautiful because she is good. And if we perhaps didn't have a good mother, we wouldn't have a beautiful mother. Or we have only a sort of picture that would be exalting because of its sensuousness or because of its more superficial traits. And so I would make of this aesthetic feeling something that is worked through inside, even in the baby, and put out.
Yeah. That the aesthetic concepts that we have always worked with, because we thought of it as a sophisticated and complicated, and particularly as related to education and experience as well as to character, it was essentially also an elitist concept. Now, in English literature, there is a tradition that goes back really mainly to Wordsworth that attributed intense aesthetic experience to the child. He spoke of the child as coming into the world trailing clouds of glory. He spoke of the child as apprehending splendor in the grass and things of that sort. What he meant by these clouds of glory, and what I mean by the aesthetic response, is essentially a response of awe and wonder at the complexity and marvel of the world that is given to us. In that sense, I don't mean Botticelli's Venus, because Venus is a beautiful woman. I mean that the awe and wonder that you have when you look at Botticelli's Venus, that anybody could paint such a picture. Now, in this sense, the aesthetic response is not a response to the beauty of the world. It apprehends the wonder of the world as beauty. Now, of course, what we're concerned with in psychoanalysis is not so much primarily with people's response to the beauty of the world out there. We're mainly concerned with people's response to the beauty that they find in their intimate relationships to other human beings. Now, because the aesthetic response to other human beings is fraught with this aesthetic conflict, when people withdraw from the painfulness of that experience, they may still retain their aesthetic response to the wonder of the world out there, which is not so fraught with conflict. We can admire the beauty of the landscape without the pain of uncertainty about its intentions. But when we admire and respond to the beauty of art, or when a mathematician says that a certain formulation is beautiful, or a musician looks at a score and says it's a beautiful score, he's not responding to the beauty of nature out there. He's responding to the beauty of nature in here. Beauty of the human mind. Now, in Melanie Klein's theory of development, she operated on an assumption which was universal at that time, that development of the mind goes from simplicity to complexity. And therefore, she assumed, when she defined what she called the two positions of paranoid schizoid and depressive positions, that naturally, because of the simplicity of the relationships and the ideas in the paranoid schizoid position, it must come first. The theory of aesthetic conflict turns this on its head and says, no, if we are right in thinking that the baby's first experience is of awe and wonder at the beauty of its mother as the representative of the world, then its initial position is a depressive position, but that it is driven from this depressive position of awe and wonder and love by the impact of the conflict. And this conflict not only comes, as Kleinian theory has generally assumed, from experiences either of separation or bad experiences, but the conflict also comes from the painfulness of the presence of the object whose outside is known and its inside is unknown. But therefore, that the painfulness of these initial experiences are tolerable insofar, as I say, they are reciprocated. And of course, for the baby, the primary evidence of reciprocation is the feed at the breast. Become aware in our psychoanalytic work, probably mainly in the last 15 years, that the baby's relationship to the nipple is a very complicated relationship. That it is, first of all, a relationship that involves the baby in coping with the nipple and the breast as a combined object having both paternal and maternal significance. So the connection between the nipple and the mother's eyes that look at the baby either with understanding and comprehension and lively interest, or at the other extreme may look blank and dead and without interest. If we have time, I'll tell you a marvelous dream from a patient that illustrates this connection between eyes and nipples and the way in which the nipple can become a terrifying object. This is from fairly early in the analysis of a woman who in fact was an illegitimate child but was raised in an atmosphere of untruthfulness, that her mother was married to her father and that he was a hero and died in the war as an RAF pilot. And she was raised by her mother in the grandparents' home in this atmosphere of extreme intimacy with her mother, which was suddenly fractured when her mother remarried when the patient was 12 and her world sort of fell apart, with the idea that she'd had an idyllic, lovely relationship to her mother up to that point. Now, she came to analysis ostensibly because she was doing a psychotherapy training, and she presented herself as having virtually no emotional difficulties. Oh, yes, she was a little frightened of birds. It was the only symptom she told me about. After several months of therapy, when we were getting on a little bit, but very slowly because she was very rigid and proper and self-idealizing, she brought a dream that at the end of a session, she dreamed that at the end of a session, she pulled a hat down over her face and walked out of the room, and as she walked out, she felt me kiss her as she passed. And I interpreted to her that that was the imaginary kiss of the imaginary father of her first 12 years of life. She seemed to have no response to that interpretation. But the next session, she brought a dream in which her daughter had the most furious temper tantrum because her pony in a horse show had spitefully kicked over the last fence and therefore didn't win the prize. The following session, she brought this marvelous dream. In the dream, she was visiting a middle-aged woman. She didn't know why, but she noticed that there was a bird, that the woman had a pet bird flying about in the room. This bird came and flew over to her and settled on her neck and climbed down inside her jumper to between her breasts. And the patient, as she described it, was paralyzed with terror. She couldn't scream, she couldn't do anything about it. She was absolutely immobilized. The middle-aged woman seemed to recognize that she was frightened and went out of the room and came back with a big earthenware jug. And this jug was very particular. It was an earthenware jug, and it was very rough around the sides, and on the top, instead of earthenware, there was a white plastic lid. And the woman brought this jug, took the lid off, held it by and pulled her jumper out, and the bird flew right into the jug. To my amazement, the patient herself said she knows what the jug was, that the jug was my head with my fuzzy hair and my bald top. And not only did she know that, but that she realized that she was now frightened of my looking at her. So you see the connection between the breasts and the eyes, and you see also how a transference emerges, that something that has been an internal object, a terrifying internal object, that has been externalized as a phobia, comes into the analyst and becomes part of the analyst as an object.